Our docket this afternoon is 25-20292, Rivera versus Ross Dress for Less. Mr. McDonald.
May it please the court, I'm Cullen McDonald. I represent the appellant, Lourdes Rivera. This case presents two issues. Each of them independently could warrant reversal. The first issue is waiver of Ross's right to arbitrate. Under Morgan versus Sundance and this court's decision last year in Garcia versus Fuentes, waiver is now the knowing relinquishment of a known right assessed under the totality of the circumstances. Ross removed this case to federal court, never filed with their answer in general denial an arbitration affirmative defense, proceeded to litigate for 15 months in federal court before moving for arbitration. Each of those acts independently may not constitute waiver, but as the court states in Garcia, the relevant inquiry is the totality of the circumstances and context must control. And so we have to look at what occurred during those 15 months. And what occurred here in the 15 months were three depositions were taken, including the deposition of Mrs. Rivera, including another deposition, or two depositions rather, of Ross employees. The parties filed a joint management report, which asked about alternative dispute resolution tactics or techniques, and mediation was mentioned, but arbitration was not, despite Ross's concession that arbitration had been in effect at Ross since 2013. There was no mention of an intention to arbitrate. Following that, there was a joint continuance filed by the parties to prepare the case for trial. That was what was represented to the district court.
That seems most distinctive to me, that final step. We need to get experts. We want to mediate. We want to continue the trial. But all those things could be described as just fulfilling the legal obligations as opposed to acts that are an intentional relinquishment of the mandatory right.
And so I think, right?
And then we have Garcia, where you happen to have the huge plus factor of I forego it.
Right.
Which we don't have here.
We do not have that here. But coupled with that in Garcia, what we had was the affirmative representation that we do not intend to seek arbitration at this time.
Well,
or something
almost
similar.
Conclusive, right?
I agree. But following that is only 3 months of litigation, minimal discovery. And so while we do not have the affirmative representation from Ross that we do not intend to seek arbitration at this time.
I guess I'm wondering, what's the ingredient X? Because, and this may be blaming ourselves. We've got cases all over there saying, this is enough for waiver, this isn't. So if we really want to add predictability and litigants in the future, fine. She began it in court. We'll fulfill our obligations, but we don't mean to surrender our right to compel. So is there an ingredient X in this case, something that makes for a brighter line rule?
I think that we actually fit well under Garcia's rule. I don't know that the court needs to extend it and create
the excessive time.
Correct. I think that the 14 or 15 months combined with their intention by removing the federal court in the first instance.
That's clearly not enough. But go ahead.
I agree, Judge. It's not enough in isolation. But, you know, for instance, they could have filed a motion to compel arbitration in state court in Houston, and they didn't. So that was the first step in the chain. They subsequently litigated the case for 14 or 15 more months. They conducted three depositions. You know, the parties conducted three depositions.
Did we have a discovery schedule? Do we have a joint pretrial order? Had discovery closed? Had deadlines for dispositive motions been set? Where were we in all of that?
So the depositions of Mrs. Rivera occurred in August of 2022. That was about 1 month after the court entered its joint scheduling order. So we were within the discovery phase of the district court lawsuit at that time.
So a discovery order had been in effect for 1 month when the three depositions occurred.
Whenever the first deposition had occurred. The remaining two depositions did not occur until February of 2023. So that's about a 7 month delay or
well,
lapse.
Did we have a discovery cutoff? Did we have a date for, did we have a pretrial order? Where were we? And everybody agreed this is all the discovery we're going to do. We're going to plan more. What was the status?
So normally we have a
pretrial order.
Sure, and that was the pretrial order that I was talking about back in July of 2022. However, after Lourdes Rivera designated her expert witnesses, the party jointly moved for a continuance. And at that time, after her experts were designated, there was about 7 or 8 months before the trial setting. So then the parties moved jointly for a continuance to...
When was the trial set? Everybody recognized discovery's done? What? We got a trial date?
I think discovery was still ongoing, Judge. There was just that, you know, the hard... I would have to double-check the dates that were included in the discovery scheduling order, but...
What was the reason or basis for the motion for continuance?
As it was represented to the district court, it was to prepare the case for trial. There were activities or actions that still needed to be completed. And that goes part and parcel with the representations at the depositions where, counsel for Ross indicates we will reserve our questions for trial. And again, I understand that that can be in isolation, just a statement made in the course of a proceeding or just a kind of part of the litigation. But the I think differentiator is you have to combine everything under Garcia. And so you combine the removal with the lapse of time of 14 or 15 months with the joint continuance to prepare the case for trial with the conducting of depositions. And that is only the joint continuance is moved for after Rivera designates her experts. So Ross now has that information at his disposal. And then there's a joint continuance whenever all along they knew that they had the right to arbitrate. And so I think that is the critical factor is Garcia says
when the court compels arbitration, at that point the court stayed the proceedings.
That's right.
So you had no opportunity to appeal that order at that point?
That's correct. It was interlocutory at that point, and so the court compelled arbitration and administratively stayed the case. It didn't close the proceedings.
So then we get to the award, and it's adverse to you, and a big issue in this case is no motion to vacate.
That's right.
So how is it that we can affect the award if there wasn't ever a motion to vacate the award?
So our position is under issue one, if, for instance, say the court finds that Ross, as a matter of law, waived his right to arbitration, which it can do under a de novo standard.
Right.
You wouldn't be vacating the arbitrator's award in any substantive sense under section 10A4 of exceeding their authority or any of the other sections of the statute. Really, because we now have a final judgment from the district court from which we're appealing, we're really appealing under waiver the reverse, or we're seeking the reversal of the district court's order compelling arbitration.
Do you have any case where that's happened? If we're looking at the FAA, it does seem like if you think there's a flaw, you've got to move to vacate. And if you don't, you're in peril. Here, the notice to confirm was after the 30 days that you would have to have moved to vacate, correct?
Yes, it was after the 3-month deadline in the FAA.
So she misses the 3-month deadline. Why does the, oh goodness, I should have done that, I'm going to file a notice to confirm, pull it back to life? Or do you think they're two totally different creatures?
I think they're two totally different creatures.
But do you have any case that says that?
I couldn't find specifically that case, but there are some Fifth Circuit cases that review the arbitrability of disputes after a final judgment has been entered or a final award has been entered in arbitration. So,
do they address 9 U.S.C. Section 12?
They do, but not in the context of waiver of a right to arbitration, which is a pre-arbitration, pre-order compelling arbitration issue. So the cases that discuss the interplay.
I was looking briefly this morning, and there are lots of cases that say it's a statute of limitations, that if you don't move within that 3 months, you can't appeal. And I haven't gotten into it. I just didn't see a case that said, unless you're challenging the referral to arbitration in the first instance. Seems like y'all should have briefed this better than you did.
And that could be the case, Judge. And I believe, are saying the same thing, that there aren't cases that specifically discuss waiver and the interplay with the failure to file a motion to vacate.
I mean, did you look?
I did.
Okay.
Yes, Judge, I did.
Did parties cite Wilson v. Kemper? Does that case ring a bell, Wilson v. Kemper?
Yes, Kemper, yes, Kemper. That case rings a bell, yes.
Is that touching on the issue or not?
It does a little bit, but I think that under issue one in this case, the waiver issue, if the panel says there was waiver as a matter of law, then we wouldn't be bound by the statutory requirements to then enter, confirm, modify, or vacate an award from arbitration. It's almost as if the arbitration never should have occurred in the first instance.
I just want a case that says that. You know?
I understand, Judge, and I couldn't find one myself. But that's the position that appellants bring to this court, is that the district court erred because of all of the circumstances, and it didn't even have Garcia's benefit at the time that it decided this case. It took a guess based on the Morgan versus Sundance opinion and said that there are three district court cases, including Volmering and a couple of others, that the substantial invocation of the judicial process would be the only way to show waiver. And that's not the case. That Garcia says that it is one way, but it is not the only way, because you must focus on the knowing relinquishment of the known right to arbitrate. And so, at a minimum, the district court, because they didn't have the benefit to evaluate the waiver standard under the waiver issue under the correct standard as prescribed by the Fifth Circuit, we could remand for an evaluation under Garcia. But in terms of a case that talks about the motion to vacate combined with...
Did you find any Section 12 cases in the opposite posture where the motion to vacate was filed premised on the fact that the district court made a legal error in referring it to the arbitrator? What would an arbitrator do? Would it sit in review of the district court order?
I believe it would be the inverse of that. The district court would review, just like they have to confirm an arbitrator's award.
So you file the motion to vacate, but you file the motion to vacate under Rule 12, and the district court then would be reviewing its own original order?
No, that presents a kind of a conundrum of issues. I didn't find a case specifically on that, but in the motion to confirm context, if Ross had filed a motion to confirm and we opposed, then I believe that the district court would be required to evaluate whether or not the original order should be vacated.
But instead, you moved to confirm.
We moved to confirm, and because we wanted to perfect the final judgment so that we could appeal under Section 16 of the FAA, which you can appeal an order confirming an arbitrator's award.
But you moved to confirm more than 3 months after the...
That's right, yes. And you can move to confirm at any point within 1 year of the arbitrator's award. So we moved to confirm in April of 2025. And then Ross separately moved to confirm. And then the district court entered or granted Ross's motion to confirm.
And what did you tell the district court about 9 U.S.C. Section 12? What was argued?
Nothing was argued. Nothing was argued.
It was mentioned in the pleadings of the district court.
Yes, it was mentioned in Ross's motion to confirm, and Rivera did not mention 9 U.S.C. 12 in her motion to confirm. The purpose of Rivera's motion to confirm was to inform the district court that arbitration had completed. We have an award. If you confirm the award, we're going to seek an appeal under Section 16 of the FAA of the entire, the entire arbitrator's award and final judgment. Which is what we're doing right now, and we think that waiver.
Why would you move to affirm an award that was against you?
Well, because the reason that was done is because we needed to perfect a final judgment, and so that was one avenue.
That doesn't make sense to me. It seems to me you would say we shouldn't be bound by this because you shouldn't have referred it in the first place.
Well, Your Honor, we did raise that below. We opposed the motion to compel arbitration on waiver grounds.
No, but once you get to the back end and you've lost, why would you ask to confirm the loss? That doesn't make sense to me.
Right. The only reason would be to get a final judgment.
You couldn't do a motion to vacate instead?
We could have, but we did not, Your Honor. Yes, the 9 U.S.C. 12 would say within 3 months you need to file a motion to vacate. But because we raised the waiver issue below and opposed the arbitration order in the first instance, that was preserved. And so that's what we're challenging on appeal under the new standard of Garcia versus Fuentes that the district court didn't have at the time.
So you asked the district court to confirm the award, and now you're saying you want the award set aside.
So we asked the district court to confirm the award, not on substantive grounds. It was more so, and I understand how that sounds, but it was more so because that was the next procedural step in the chain of events so that we could, under Section 16 of the FAA, appeal the case. It wasn't a consent or, you know, we are waiving any of our arguments to challenge the award. It was more so the arbitration has been completed. It was what we deem improperly dismissed on statute of limitations grounds. Therefore, district court, please enter a final judgment from which we can take this appeal now. And I want to talk a little bit more about the district court's order. I've discussed briefly the memorandum opinion that didn't have Garcia's guidance, but it also relied on cases that predated Morgan. And so part of the issue with the district court's order compelling arbitration in the first instance is it cites to the Walker versus J.C. Bradford case and the Tinico case, both of which are pre-Morgan versus Sundance opinions that rely on or invoke the prejudice prong. And so that's an additional ground that the district court, we believe, erred, and this court can remand for a proper evaluation under Garcia that no longer uses the prejudice prong or requires a prejudice prong to be proven by a party opposing arbitration.
Did either party bring up the Texas Civil Code as to statute of limitations in the context of arbitrations where the matter first goes into court? Are you familiar with that?
The 2-year statute of limitations on Ms. Rivera's claim?
Well, whether or not statute of limitations are told when claims are first brought in court.
That was briefed, and they were not told.
They weren't.
They were not told, and that was part of the arbitrator's reasoning. Once we had the district court order compelling arbitration with a finding that the claim for arbitration was not void or deemed waived, our position is that the safe harbor provision of the arbitration agreement kicked in, which would have provided Ms. Rivera 30 days within
right.
which.
I'm not focused on the safe harbor provision. I just thought that Texas law told statute of limitations in the context of arbitration for the amount of time that they're in court.
That was not the case here, Judge.
Okay.
Yes. And I see I'm running out of time. I'll address more questions on rebuttal.
Did you get clear of these with the clerk's office ahead of time? And with
I'm sorry, Judge.
Did you clear these with the clerk's office and opposing counsel ahead of time?
I have given it to opposing counsel, and I thought I was following the procedure of the court to give it to the bailiff to give you. That's what the instructions were, to give it to you before we began argument.
Okay. We'll worry about it later.
I apologize if I violated any procedure. I thought we were doing it correctly.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Bill Ashcraft, and along with Len Blakeman, who prepared our briefing for this case, we're here to represent Ross Dress for Less, Inc. In presenting our arguments, I will address the following points. First, Ross did not waive arbitration because it did not substantially invoke the judicial process prior to moving to compel arbitration. My second point will be that the district court properly confirmed the arbitration award because there is no basis for vacating the award. If I could, I will address now my first point, that Ross did not waive arbitration because it did not substantially invoke the judicial process. As this court stated in Garcia, in judging whether a party substantially invokes the judicial process, whether waiver occurred depends on whether the party knowingly relinquished its right to arbitrate by acting inconsistent with that right. And this court has stated that whether the party waived that right to arbitrate is necessarily a fact-intensive inquiry, and context controls. So courts will examine a party's acts to determine if they suggest an intent to remain in court. This court has stated in Garcia that it will review the totality of the circumstances and to consider whether or not a party has waived its right to arbitrate. So in that event, the significant events that relate to this appeal are important. And for that reason, I provided the court with a timeline that I think makes it very easy to see how everything developed and why things happened the way they did.
You did remove it from state court to federal court.
Oh, absolutely, okay. Your Honor.
And then
you
litigated for 2-3 times the amount of length of time that there was litigation in Garcia.
Yes, that is an accurate statement.
And what caught my eye was the joint motion to get experts to prepare for trial, to mediate, even asking the court to reset the trial date. That's a pretty big panoply that suggests you're committed to the litigation process.
I would disagree with that.
Even though throughout you know you've got a right to compel arbitration.
No, I would not say that that's correct. If I could, Judge, I'll take that directly.
Yeah.
I'm a defense lawyer, and anytime a defense lawyer begins to work on a case, it's very important that you get the lay of the land as to what you have and documents and information that you obtain from the client. Did we know that there was an arbitration agreement that had been agreed to by Rivera? Oh, absolutely, we knew that. We knew about the training. We had the documents related to the training. What we do not know is Ms. Rivera's perspective on whether she received that training, whether she agrees she received that training, whether she got a copy of the summary plan description, and therefore it's very important that a party be allowed to conduct basic discovery to address that.
Okay, so the explanation for why your first answer didn't include it, but the second one did, is that you learned that even though she's Spanish-speaking, she had it translated? Is that the
explanation? That was part of it, and that was easily dealt with, and Judge Hanks did an excellent job, I think, addressing that in his decision. And he concluded that she did get notice of the arbitration requirement. He specifically addressed that she got the summary plan description, and she admitted that she got the summary plan description in her deposition. And in fact, her counsel came on the record and stated, we stipulate that she got the summary plan description, which means she had notice of the arbitration provision.
But what she had notice of, I guess, after Morgan, none of that's really relevant, is it?
Oh, no.
Focused on what your client did. Did your client take steps that were inconsistent with arbitration? It's not whether she was prejudiced, right?
Oh, prejudice has nothing to do with
waiver. So the takeaway from Morgan was we look at your client's actions and we ask the full constellation, de novo, we're looking at this new. How does this compare to, say, Garcia?
It compares very favorably to Garcia. Okay. Garcia is very distinguishable on its facts. And first of all, let me make the statement. The Garcia decision was wonderfully written, and it was rightly decided on the facts that was presented to the court. Our facts are entirely different. In Garcia, what happened was the parties had their conference and they entered a joint management report, and they were specifically asked, are you looking at mediation and arbitration? And the defendant stated, we do not intend to pursue arbitration. They went on the record to say that, and they submitted that.
It does jump out at you, but Garcia's been the law for a while, and I haven't found any cases that describe it as that was the conclusive fact.
I'm sorry.
I have not seen any cases. It's been favorably cited. I don't see cases that say that was determinative.
Oh, I think my reading of the decision is that the cascade fell hard on the restaurant defendants because they made that statement that they intended to not pursue arbitration. And the court said that that was an overt act statement and that then the court looks at everything that followed after that. The discovery they did, whether the issues of mediation and everything that followed that they did that was of a nature of litigation, they felt in line.
And I agree. In a direct, explicit statement, I don't want arbitration, sounds pretty inconsistent with saying arbitration. I agree. But why isn't it just as inconsistent if you don't assert your right to arbitration until after there can be no arbitration? So facts here, where your assertion of your right to arbitrate only occurs after there can't be any arbitration. How isn't that just as inconsistent?
If I could, I'll use the timeline to explain.
Yes.
All right. If you take a look at the timeline, first of all, and this will spend most of my time, but I think this is a good use of time, and I welcome the questions. Rivera was trained two times on the arbitration provisions. That's important because she has to have notice of those arbitration provisions, and by remaining in employment after she has notice of the provisions, that's what creates the agreement to arbitrate. And therefore, if later a dispute develops over an employee injury, then she must demand arbitration. If she does not, she's in breach of contract. In this case, she waited 19 months after the incident.
But you're blaming her, and I'm just, and I don't want to detract you from this. It'll be very helpful to me. But I'm just focusing on the actions of your client. And am I right or am I wrong factually that your client doesn't invoke the right to arbitration until after there cannot be any arbitration? Is that correct or wrong factually?
That's true. But again, there's more to the story. So what happens is that she gets trained on the arbitration provisions. The incident occurs. She then files an original petition in state court. We file our answer, and in that answer, we do not assert any affirmative defenses. Why? Because I, as a defense attorney, want to make sure I conduct basic discovery before I determine what my affirmative defenses are. Once I understand that I've got a meritorious affirmative defense, then I'll...
So accepting your word, you're aware of your arbitration right, but you're not sure you're protecting her. You want to make sure that she fully understood. You're waiting.
Well, I'm actually fully protecting my client because I want to make sure that if I raise a defense of arbitration that is meritorious, that there's a basis in law and fact.
How do you get to the point that you only finally pull the trigger when it can't occur?
I'll explain.
Yeah.
So what you have is we file our original answer. We don't raise defenses. We then remove to federal court, which we have the right to do, and there's certainly no waiver in that under the decisions of this court. They waited 19 months before they filed their suit. So there was only about, there were five months remaining, after the incident occurred, after the petition was filed, there were only 5 months remaining until the statute ran.
Right.
So in other words, in some respects, the plaintiff brought this, Rivera brought this on herself.
You're eating your time up. Let me try to be more direct. You took Ms. Rivera's deposition in August of 22, and I assume you confirmed in that deposition that she had read the agreement, she understood it, she'd gotten the training. You didn't assert arbitration in your answer for the first time until March of 23. What was the delay in your asserting arbitration once you found out, yes, indeed, Rivera knew she had the obligation to arbitrate, we have an agreement, what took you so long?
Okay, if you will, you'll see that counsel brought this up when he was talking. It was approximately 5 months, 4 or 5 months after I took the deposition of the plaintiff that they had been wanting to take the deposition of Mr. Alvarez, our store manager. Again, to make sure that we had the foundation to assert a defense, we wanted to get through that deposition of Mr. Alvarez. Keep in mind, by this time, the statute of limitations is run. Judge Higginson has made that point. It is run by now. But at the same time, we're going to make a motion, and if it's granted, which it was granted by Judge Hanks, there can be appeals, and that's where we are now. So we want to make sure that we've got good, solid foundation. So Mr. Alvarez's deposition was taken by counsel, so we wanted to wait until Alvarez was deposed.
Did you tell counsel, were you communicating with, you didn't tell counsel anything about arbitration, though? You were just waiting to see?
I did not, but we did produce.
But surely they got a whiff of the arbitration possibilities when you were asking Ms. Rivera questions about arbitration.
Oh, absolutely, and that's an excellent point. We gave our initial disclosures to counsel right on the time that was required by the joint scheduling order, the first joint scheduling order, and we gave them the plan, the SPD, and we also gave them the training materials. So they had full notice of it then. And then
and when
in her
was
deposition.
That? What date was that?
I'm sorry, date for what?
What you just said. You said we gave them what you just said, we gave them all this by such and such deadline.
Right.
What deadline was that?
If you'll look on 6-10-22,
okay,
the case management plan.
By then, you had given them the arbitration agreement.
And then on 7-22-22, we timely served our initial disclosures, including the production of the plan, the SPD, and the training module.
So you produced information confirming that she knew about, that she had the arbitration agreement, that she'd been trained. You took her deposition the next month and asked her questions about, did she understand that she had an obligation to arbitrate?
Right. We went through all of that with her.
So there was some discussion of arbitration as early as August of 22.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we discussed this thoroughly in her deposition. They would have known there that arbitration was in play in her deposition. And they should have known that.
And I don't understand why. Did you tell them we'll wait to file a demand for arbitration until after you depose Mr. Alvarez? Or what? I don't understand why that was important.
Well, it's important because what we're trying to do is to make sure that we want to hear what Mr. Alvarez has questioned on to see if that is going to bear on the assertion of an arbitration defense.
And Alvarez was your employee.
Yes, ma'am.
You could have gone to Alvarez any time before February of 23 to see what he was going to say, couldn't you?
Oh, no. I think I knew what Mr. Alvarez would say because I was going to work with him to prepare his affidavit.
Then why did you need his deposition?
I want to see if there was anything that they get from him in his deposition that would cause a problem in making a motion to compel arbitration. By this time, they had the information the SPD, the summary plan description, and, of course, we had taken the deposition of the plaintiff. I wanted to see if they were going to ask Mr. Alvarez questions about arbitration to see how that would affect our being able to raise the defense. And the main thing...
What's wrong with my thinking, though? These are a lot of tactical thoughts that lead you to caution. But nevertheless, when you finally move for arbitration, it's not available.
It's not available.
There is
but the
no
fact
possibility
that,
of it.
That
so it looks to me like all the tactical thinking in the middle of court litigation is inconsistent with any possibility of arbitration.
Not possibility of arbitration by us. The problem is, Judge, is that here's the problem, is that it has to be understood that she was trained on the policy, she knew the requirement to arbitrate. It was
I guess I'm maybe you're right. We'll study this more. But you keep focusing on what she did. And yet I think the Supreme Court has told us the whole focus is on what you did. That's how waiver works.
Right.
Did you take acts that are inconsistent with invoking arbitration? And so far, everything that's occurred, even months after the statute of limitations, is still courtroom tactics. And when you do finally alert them to something that you've known throughout, there's no possibility of arbitration.
Well, there's no possibility. She has busted the statute of limitations.
Well, I don't understand that. I thought the law was, if you're in court, that tolls limitations. I thought the law was, if you're in court, that tolls limitations.
The tolling, the provision of the plan states that if a dispute develops, the employee must demand arbitration within the statute of limitations for the underlying claim, which would be 2 years, and filing suit in court will not toll the statute of limitations.
Okay, can that trump Texas law? Can the parties contract out of Texas law saying commencing an action asserting a claim by filing a suit in a court of competent jurisdiction will toll the applicable limitations period for arbitration?
It is very consistent with Texas law. This plan provision that I've just described to you has been upheld in any number of decisions in Texas.
So you acknowledge the law in Texas says you can't do it, but parties can contract out of the law, and that's what they did here. Is that what you're saying?
I think it's consistent with Texas law, consistent with the decisions.
I'm a little lost, but...
I do.
Okay.
But anyway... I've taken a lot. I always take people's time off, so I don't want to do it too. Could you jump to the really difficult Section 12 issue? The parties didn't fully brief, but let's imagine we did think Garcia suggested we have a waiver problem. We haven't decided that. I'm just saying, imagine that world. Is it true then that nonetheless she can't take it? She can't find a way to challenge the motion to compel unless she does it through a motion to vacate? Is that the law? Do you follow, or am I being too close?
No, I think I understand, Judge, and I have looked at that issue, and we have looked at this issue. This is the way we see it.
Yeah, thank you.
The ability to appeal on the waiver issue, when Judge Hanks, we think, correctly stated that there was no waiver and granted our motion to compel arbitration, that would be reviewable.
No, but he stayed the case, so there's no final order. It's not reviewable at the moment of his order. How is it reviewable? Only through a Section 12 motion to vacate?
I think it's...
Think it is reviewable at the time of the order?
I think it would be viewable when he enters the final judgment.
That's if he dismissed the case, but he didn't.
Well, he did enter a final judgment,
Why do you say it's a final judgment?
Because he stated it was final.
But it's an interlocutory ruling if he then turns around and stays the litigation in front of him. Do you have a case that says...
Well, I think the confusion here is that he stayed the case and wouldn't allow it. And basically, he stayed the case to let it go to arbitration. The arbitrator then granted our motion for summary judgment based on statute of limitations. What should have happened is that if they wanted to challenge that, they should have, within 3 months, filed a motion to vacate.
That's what I was asking, but I thought a second ago you were saying what they should have done was try to do an interlocutory appeal of the motion to compel, the order to compel.
Which they can't do.
Yeah, no, I agree.
The final judgment wasn't entered until June of 25. So you're saying they couldn't appeal in any event until June of 25?
Are you saying, did you just say the final judgment was the order to compel and they had to appeal then? Or do you agree with us that they couldn't appeal that?
They could not appeal at that time.
Okay.
No, they could not appeal at that time.
So then you say you've looked into it. We greatly appreciate that. So is it true that the method of attacking a federal district court's order is a Section 12 motion to vacate? Is that the only way to do it? You can't do what they did?
They should have done a motion to vacate, which they failed to do. And they never filed a motion to vacate. We made a motion to confirm the arbitration award. They also made a motion. They also made a motion for entry of judgment, specifically stating, we'd like to appeal, but we can't do it unless you sign off on a judgment. We filed basically a response to that and said we made a motion to confirm the judgment, explaining what had happened in the arbitration. He confirmed that judgment, and they have appealed.
All right, let's get back to Section 12. What did your research tell you?
My research tells me that that Rivera should have filed a motion to vacate on grounds permitted by the Federal Arbitration Act, which their complaint is that the arbitrator exceeded his authority and they should have made a motion to vacate within 3 months. They failed to do that.
What are the cases that you found that said that?
I think we've cited them in the brief. I'm sorry, Judge.
I don't think you cited any cases, but if you did, we'll go back and look.
All
those
right.
Are the only ones you found.
How is the argument that the arbitrator exceeded his or her authority? The argument is the district court erred in its motion in its order compelling a transfer.
Well, what they're complaining to the court about in this appeal, they cannot complain about the arbitrator. You're correct on that, because they basically are taking the position that by granting the motion for summary judgment, he exceeded his authority. If they wanted to make that claim, they had to do it by motion to vacate. They did not do that. They never did that. Even when we went back, even when we confirmed the award, they did not make any attempt to put those grounds in front of Judge Hanks.
Tricky.
And that concludes my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to touch on something that was just discussed. I agree with counsel that we could not have appealed until there was a final judgment in the district court. And that's, in fact, exactly what we did. And so I think some of the confusion is from the blurred lines between a separate motion to vacate the arbitrator's award versus Rivera challenging the order compelling arbitration.
Is the motion to vacate required before you can challenge the award?
I couldn't find any case law that says, under the waiver context, that a motion to vacate an award that we are now arguing should never have been entered because it shouldn't have been compelled, that a motion to vacate is required. I read Section 12 to, you know, say that if you're only challenging the arbitrator's award in itself, then yes, a motion to vacate would be, you know, I presume required. But issue number one is waiver, and so that's pre-arbitration conduct. And so our position is it would seem to be, you know, incompatible with the waiver standards and from the Supreme Court to impose an additional statutory requirement that is in the FAA if the court is then saying, well, it never should have gone to arbitration in the first place. And so I think to constrict our relief by filing a motion to vacate under Section 12 whenever we are arguing that this was improperly compelled.
Well, that would be the grounds for the motion to vacate. You had 3 months after you lost in arbitration to go back into the district court, who still had jurisdiction, and say, we want you to vacate because you should never have sent it there in the first place. And he says, motion denied, here's your final judgment, and then you come on up. Instead, you ask him to confirm the arbitration award, which awarded your client $0.
That's right. We did that because we wanted to have a final judgment from which we could appeal.
But you asked for a judgment against yourself, your client.
Really,
that's what really is mind-boggling to me.
I understand. And the reason that was done was really more procedural grounds to wrap this up in June.
Why it seems like 9 U.S.C. 12 is the way to go. You say, we shouldn't have been there in the first place. You should vacate it and let us go up on appeal.
I hear you, Judge, and I think that the waiver standards, I would say, take precedent over that because we are arguing that it never should have been there in the first place, and therefore to impose the statutory requirements of the FAA is an additional requirement that is not found in the Supreme Court jurisprudence. If there are no further questions, I'll cede my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We have your argument. The court is, have we concluded our arguments for this week? And the cases are under submission. Thank you.